dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host. We are joining several of the best in the business in an exploration of various fronts in what I think of as the battle space of the war for the free world. And it's always a treat to be able to spend some of our time getting the perspective of a guy who understands how the boots on the ground feel about the fol-de-rol that highfalutin policy types are involved in, what it really means for our troops. And that's Jim Hansen, of course, of Black5.net, Warrior Legacy Foundation. He's also the Director for Business Development of Absio. And Jim, we've been talking for some time now about what's going on in Afghanistan. The morning news reports that there is the last offensive underway there now, the last NATO-US-led offensive, that is. And I wonder, as a military man yourself with the special forces and distinguished record there, how do we know that it's the last offensive unless we're, in effect, declaring that we've lost and we will not fight in an offensive fashion from here on out?
Yeah, I find the idea of announcing a last offensive to be offensive. I mean, at the bottom line, it's just what you said. We know that the game is over. I mean, I don't remember hearing the Taliban and Al-Qaeda surrender. So obviously, you know, we haven't won. And given the fact if we're announcing that this is the last offensive we're going to have, then potentially we absolutely are announcing we've lost. And I think that's extremely disheartening for anybody in theater, anybody who's been to theater, and anybody who now is planning to deploy to theater. Because why are they going?
At a minimum, Jim Hansen, they're being told we're on defense until we've wrapped this thing up. Our guys will presumably be more or less confined to bases. I guess this doesn't preclude, you know, excursions with the Afghans in the lead and all that. But certainly in terms of major operations to try to defeat the enemy, that seems as though it's all over now.
It is over. And okay, yeah, we may go on, as you call them, I think excursions is a great word for what we go out on with the Afghans. I don't consider those to be particularly legitimate operations. And, you know, the Afghans have, there are some decent Afghan combat units, but overall their security forces and their military is a non-starter as far as their ability, as you mentioned, to actually defeat the enemy. So we have decided at best we have a withdrawal to bases and a stand and wait for the call to come home. And I just don't understand where that leaves us strategically. I don't understand where it leaves us with everyone who has fought, shed blood, and, you know, been there trying to make something happen. How can you feel that that was worth your time, given the fact that now we're just going to walk away?
Yeah. Well, let alone, as you say, Jim Hansen, the folks who are being asked to deploy in what remains of this time in Afghanistan, it's just got to be heartbreaking and demoralizing in the extreme for them and their families, of course. This is coming at the same time, Jim, as the Secretary of Defense is issuing new warnings about the dire repercussions of the budget cuts that are now ordered by law for our military. The question, I guess, that occurs to me is, are we really witnessing at the moment that this thing is unraveling in Afghanistan, the signal being sent that it's unraveling more generally, and that we are therefore going to find ourselves with considerably more setbacks, reverses, defeats, as people take stock of what we're doing and what the opportunities therefore are for them to work against our interest?
No doubt. You know, I mean, absolutely no doubt about that. I think, you know, when you hear Secretary Panetta, who I gain respect for, I guess, pretty much every time I see him put on the hot spot. I was worried about him being just a political tool that Obama had put into the CIA and then into defense. But he seems to be a stand-up guy in both of those roles. And when he says that we can't do this, you know, I can't even tell you what the results are going to be, and that coming from the Secretary of Defense to these across-the-board type cuts, you have to take that seriously. And if you're our enemy, you have to take that as an opportunity. You know, and let's not forget, Vladimir Putin just thumbed his nose at Obama, refused to meet at him, didn't even show up for the G8 summit. You know, and he's got bad things going on. They're supplying arms to Syria. You know, the Chinese communists have any number of bad things going on, and last time I checked, there are bankers, and we tend to bow down to them whenever necessary. So the threats are there, and those people are going to be emboldened by the fact that we are hollowing out our military. It's a major problem.
Speaking of the Chinese and speaking of bowing down, we have this same Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, off this week to Asia for what I think of as kind of charm offensive there. I think trying to charm our allies into believing that we're going to be present, we're going to be robust, we're going to have their back. I'll be talking more about this with Gordon Chang a little later in the show. But Jim Hansen, you've spent time in the special forces in the Pacific. What, in your estimation, are people there going to make of the representations by Leon Panetta against this backdrop, against the seeming hollowing out of our military and the growing aggressiveness of the Chinese? Witness what's happening with the Filipinos at the moment.
You know, the bottom line, we're going to be present there in the same way that Obama voted present a lot of times when he was in the Illinois and U.S. Senate. You can't make those kind of cuts and make a credible idea that we're going to force project in any legitimate way. We are not in a position to state that we are the long horse or the strong horse in that area. So, I mean, they know the Chinese are there. It's the Chinese consider the bulk of that area to be their backyard, you know, the greater Chinese co-prosperity sphere to some extent. And I think that is what the people there are seeing. That is the reality they have to face. And I wouldn't want to be the one who is counting on us to push back against that, because we owe the Chinese too much money and we spend too much time trying to charm them. You know, so I don't know who I'd bet on, but it probably wouldn't be us.
Jim Hansen, there's another piece to this, of course, and that is something that's, I guess, breaking as we speak. The Chinese are not only our bankers, they're not only a growing source of supplies of things like rare earth minerals. We're also relying on them for chips and other pieces of electronic gear, some of which are migrating into our weapon systems. Tell us what we've discovered recently. An American manufacturer of these chips has got in them as a result of their production in Asia at the moment.
Yeah, well, there's been a chip found that is used in a lot of military hardware, as well as in Boeing 787 airliner, that had a back door engineered in it that allowed someone to remotely change settings on it and to basically not have to hack into it, but to have, if you had the back door key, a way right into the center of this chip. And we don't know at this point how many military systems it's in. They're still trying to figure out if it was done at the design stage in the U.S. company or if it was done in the manufacturing process overseas. But regardless, that's not an isolated problem. That is a huge cybersecurity issue, that all of our stuff, we have to control not just the design, but the supply chain and the manufacturer. And we absolutely do not have a handle on that. And I think this is the tip of the iceberg as far as our vulnerability to these kind of attacks of anyone who wants to take down, you know, our technological superiority.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, Jim. And this is one of those just absolutely crazy-making things that we've seen the U.S. government, the military, seemingly indifferent to the fact that they're relying on offshore supplies, whether it's materials or technology. It may cut costs in the very short term, but if in the, the moment of need, it winds up that these things are turned off or perhaps turned against us by such a command and a backdoor, it could be one that we rue the day we've ever allowed to happen.
Amen. And I think it's something that it's coming to the forefront now as we look at cybersecurity, as we look at cyber as a domain, like land, air, war, air and sea, as places we can be attacked. Well, we need to look at that and harden our supply chain and harden our systems.
We certainly do. Jim Hansen, I appreciate your vision on this, and you're joining us each week to discuss it. The boots on the ground perspective, as I'm fond of saying, is indispensable. It brings a measure of common sense, which is certainly needed in the councils of policymaking in Washington. And we appreciate your help. Keep up the good work at Black 5 and also at Absio, and we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Next up, we will be speaking with Congressman Mike Turner about U.S. nuclear disarmament and how it plays in all of these issues. Straight ahead.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
My name is Sunday Hollis, and I totally lost the cravings for sweets. I totally lost the cravings for bread, even meat. And some people, you know, you would see people say, oh, well, you're eating a salad because you're trying to diet, but you just don't have a taste for any of the junk anymore. And it is so, so, so true. Now, I'm thinking this is something that the celebrities are using. They're just not giving the meta system the credit for it. I've tried everything under the sun, and this is the only product that I have even called the company and asked them, could I sell it for them? This is a product where you can actually use the word awesome. I mean, and it is the whole essence of the word awesome.
Don't wait another minute to start losing weight. Call Judy Singer's The Meta System at 1-800-711-JUDY. That's 1-800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
We could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined as we have the privilege of being from time to time by Congressman Mike Turner, Republican of Ohio. He is the chairman of a very important subcommittee of the House Armed Services Committee with responsibility for strategic forces. He is also a member of the Oversight and Government Reform Committee. He has been representing, with considerable distinction, I think, Ohio's 3rd Congressional District since 2003. And, Congressman, you have been very active on a number of fronts having to do with I think of it as the wrecking operation that the Obama administration is inflicting upon the Defense Department. But nowhere is that more palpable than with respect to our nuclear deterrent. And last week we had some political cover, I think, provided, is the way I think of it at least, to the president's initiatives in this regard by a former commanding general of the Strategic Forces Command, General James Hoss Cartwright, and several others who I think should also know better, the thrust of it being that we can safely cut to just 900 weapons, 450 of them in a so-called near-alert posture, that is to say not ready to go, but maybe in 72 hours we could get them spun up to go. And the rest would be kind of on the shelf, more or less irrelevant to our deterrent requirements. as a man who is directly involved in assuring the adequacy of our deterrent posture, what's your response to this kind of proposal from people who are clearly influential with the Obama administration?
Well, it's completely irresponsible. I mean, and Frank, I appreciate you highlighting this, because this is one area where, you know, the president, with his, you know, statements of, you know, the road to zero with nuclear weapons, continues to try to push in all different categories to diminish the United States' nuclear capability, not the nuclear capability of others. No one has he persuaded to diminish their nuclear capability since he has been in office, but he has continued this push to try to lessen ours. And, you know, for General Cartwright's statements to be, you know, in concert with what the administration's view is of cutting nuclear weapons, it really just diminishes the United States. And everyone knows, you know, the world is not at risk because the United States is a strong nuclear power. The world is at risk if the United States is not a strong nuclear power because of those who do both seek nuclear weapons and, of course, you know, Russia and China being very strong nuclear states that still take an adversarial view of the world and not an allied view of the world, to put us in a posture where, you know, as you said, on the shelf, where we're a wait and see power, doesn't influence anyone. It certainly weakens, I think, our allies. You know, those who depend upon us, like Japan and others, who are not nuclear power states, who depend upon the United States being a nuclear umbrella to hold back tyranny or those that might attack, historically strong democracies, would, I believe, find themselves in a situation where they say, well, the United States no longer has a credible nuclear deterrent, that we ourselves have to now field and develop our own nuclear weapons. So it would have the effect, I think, of increasing the proliferation of nuclear weapons and the threat, not decreasing it.
Yeah, not exactly the global zero outcome that the president espouses. This is really troubling to me, as you say, Congressman Mike Turner, because when you see how the world is increasingly, in fact, awash with nuclear wannabe states, countries that are responding to the unchecked accretion of nuclear technology and capabilities by Iran, for example, you know, probably, if not in the very near future, soon, transforming the Middle East into a region in which there are lots of nuclear powers. This kind of conduct on the part of the United States, unilateral disarmament, as I think you've put it, can only be described as irresponsible. When you talk to your colleagues on Capitol Hill about this, or perhaps to your constituents, do you get any resonance at all? Are people paying any attention to these kinds of problems, or do you think that they're largely taking it for granted that we have a strong nuclear deterrent, we will always have a strong nuclear deterrent, and they think that's the way it should be?
You know, I think it is completely taken for granted, just as you just said. I mean, I think they believe that we have nuclear weapons, that we have the ability to destroy any adversary who might attack us, but they don't realize how precariously balanced it is, and that there are those that would want to diminish it and weaken our nuclear capability.
Mm-hmm. And in your markup of the Defense Authorization Bill, the National Defense Authorization Act, as I understand it, you have actually added funds into some of these nuclear-related activities, specifically to provide some production facilities. It really puts a fine point on the fact that we're not capable of just taking these things for granted, that they do age, they become obsolete, they need to be modernized. And I guess I'm asking, is your bill was debated on the House floor, or there have been controversies about adding money to defense, how has that factored into the calculation of say, your colleagues in the House?
Well, people, I think, are beginning to understand, as the president has beaten the drum for diminishing our nuclear capability, that there is something at risk. Now, we did put more money back into funding our nuclear weapons infrastructure, which is absolutely critical and essential. And you know, many people, you know, intuitively, you can think of it this way. You know, how many laptops have you had in the past decade? Well, these are nuclear weapons that are decades old, not decade. And so as you have, you know, increased technology, increased needs, in order for it to be a credible nuclear deterrent, We have to be able to maintain it. You have to be able to stand it up and modernize it. To the extent that they both want to not only not modernize, but eliminate and then, take offline, you're really getting down to the point where you see, the United States becoming less and less relevant in trying to keep the world safe.
Yeah. And this is really the rub is my guess is the most Americans wouldn't want any part of this if they knew it were happening. And but for the great work of yourself and Senator John Kyle and a few others on Capitol Hill, this would be even worse than it is right now. An example of it is, of course, what the administration was trying to do at NATO in the past week's summit. Tell us what was afoot there and what the outcome was, and should we take any heart from it?
The administration had requested that NATO undertake a nuclear and a deterrence and defense posture review, which they had signaled an openness to either, reduce or diminish or even eliminate the U.S. presence of nuclear weapons in Europe. It was not met positively by the Allies. The Allies instead issued in Chicago a very strong statement embracing NATO as a nuclear alliance and embracing the United States' strong role in NATO as contributing to that nuclear alliance. So once again, this is an area where the administration stepped out, believing that they were going to be able to convince people that the United States should diminish its capability, where people said, no, we don't want a weakened United States.
Or a weakened alliance, indeed, as they've experienced this before. We're at a moment in time when clearly the administration would like to move further. You've raised questions about what the president meant when he talked with then outgoing Russian President Medvedev, when he said, just give me a little space, I'll have more flexibility after the election. Do you have a read, Congressman Mike Turner, on what that would translate into if the president were reelected with respect to our nuclear deterrent?
Well, it's very concerning because this president has said that he has military plans of deals and agreements with those that would identify themselves as our adversary that are so controversial might affect the outcome of his election. And if he'll tell our adversaries that, but he won't tell the American people what the subject matter is, that should be of grave concern. He's clearly signaling that he's got a secret deal with the Russians with respect to missile defense, our only first line of defense if we should have a missile attack where Iran and North Korea continue to pursue missile technology to reach the United States. I think it's just absolutely outrageous and certainly have a great deal of concern.
Well, I appreciate very much what you're doing to try to get to the bottom of this by extracting information from the administration as to what those plans might be. And Congressman Mike Turner, more generally, the work that you're doing on the House Armed Services Committee's Strategic Forces Subcommittee, it is top flight, absolutely necessary and deeply appreciated, I think, by all of us who understand how important our nuclear deterrent is to the future security of this country. Keep up the good work, sir, and we look forward to talking with you again very soon. And don't let the bastards get you down. Next up, Matt Brodsky of the Jewish Policy Center talks to us about Syria. What the devil's going on there, and what the devil should we be doing about it? Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, NBA forward Kevin Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder. Here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
And that's a slam dunk.
Whether you like to shoot hoops like me, skateboard, ride a bike,
or dance on your roof, just move it your way.
For an hour a day. Because moving every day puts you on the offense towards a stronger you.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Bugs.
So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up, play, and move it your way. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
You said it at www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope in life. www.waterforcongo.com.
In 1966 in Anchorage, Alaska, a talented child was born. He would go on to be one out of only 11 Alaskans to make it to the major leagues. The odds of him striking out more than 3,000 hitters? 1 in 33 million. The odds of this pitcher being selected to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game 6 times? 1 in 48 million. The odds of this fastballing philanthropist winning the World Series 3 times? 1 in 3 million. The odds of this man having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Hi, I'm Kurt Schilling. Learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Autism is getting closer to home. From 1 in 5,000 only 20 years ago, today 1 in 110 children are diagnosed. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
What are you doing?
Filling out a loan application.
I can help you get approved, you know.
Really? How?
With this.
A bag of sand?
It's not a bag. It's a pouch. And it's not sand. It's credit fairy dust.
Credit fairy dust?
Yes. I sprinkle some fairy dust on the application, and your credit rating magically improves.
There's no such thing as the credit fairy.
An unbeliever now. But what will you think when your loan is approved?
I'll think my credit score improved because I paid my bills on time, kept my credit card balances low, and only opened a new card if I really needed it.
It's the dust.
It's sand.
Don't deny the credit fairy.
There's no magic to improving your credit, but there is help, and it's free. Go to creditfairy.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the Consumer Bankers Foundation, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights Education Fund, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by Matt Brodsky. He is the director of policy for the Jewish Policy Center in Washington, D.C. He edits its highly acclaimed In Focus Quarterly. He is also the author of the chapter of a really extraordinarily important publication entitled The World Almanac of Islamism, produced by the American Foreign Policy Council. And Matt, I want to talk to you about Syria. So figuring out exactly what is happening there, especially the dynamic between the regime and assorted Islamists, is right in the sweet spot, I think, of what you have been focusing on and working on. So give us, if you would, sort of a short course on what has happened in the past 7 or 8 months in Syria and why we should care about what goes on there.
Well, in Syria, aside from the regime killing its own people, they have, over the course of the past decade, have been empowering Salafist Islamists and shipping them over the border to kill coalition forces in Iraq. So in creating this Frankenstein, of course, jihadists are starting to return to Syria because, as it's run by an Alawite regime, they see that as heretical and they're out to get them now.
Okay, explain that to us. An Alawite regime probably doesn't mean much to anybody here, but it means a lot in the world of the Middle East.
Offshoot of Shia Islam, but the Sunnis consider it to be just not legitimate at all whatsoever. That's considered kafir, you know, they're infidels. And it's also considered.
And that's a grounds for jihad against these practitioners. Got it.
I mean, if you were to compare it even to Saddam Hussein being a Sunni, I mean, the difference would be like night and day. Of course, you would go after the Alawi regime first and foremost. And this is always going to happen at some point in Syria. This is what happens when you support those elements, you know, and try to ship them over. At some point, they're going to realize that Jihad Central is going to be in Syria, and this is where they can make their biggest mark right now.
Right. And so we've got a regime that is despotic, repressive. As you say, it's been murdering its own people. It has illegitimacy in terms of the majority of the population there, and certainly the Sunni or Salafists of the Al-Qaeda and other Muslim Brotherhood strains. Have we reached the point now, in your judgment, Matt Brodsky, that we're looking at a full-fledged civil war in Syria?
You can't have 108 people massacred in the manner it was with the UN there, of course, as we saw on Friday, and have it not be a civil war.
Are you clear about who was responsible for that?
Yeah, it would be the regime.
There's no question. Okay. It talks about militia and this and that, but it's the regime operating under the auspices of the regime.
The Shabiha, or the gangs of, you know, murderous Alawite thugs that they send in, are also responsible for it. They're all elements of the regime perpetrating these massacres.
Right. Now, Matt Brodsky, in the Times of Israel on the 24th of May, you drilled down on some of the arguments that the Assad regime is making, that, in fact, this is the work of foreign terrorists, some of whom I think they ascribe, us responsibility for supporting. Give us your sense of where the truth lies on the presence now in Syria of these folks, that some of whom have been forming a victory front, as it's calling itself. Is this a real independent threat to the regime, and are they in any way responsible for some of this bloodshed?
Here's where the truth is sticky. It's absolutely a new terrorist organization. And if you've been monitoring jihadi websites, you can witness the birth of it since December or January. And it is an indigenous terrorist organization within Syria. The foreign elements, yes, they're starting to come back, but that is not actually the biggest problem right now. Now, what's interesting, though, is the Assad regime uses this terrorist organization and inflates a lot of what they do in different cases in order to make the case that they've just been fighting al-Qaeda elements, which is the same case they've been making since the beginning. So, for instance, the May 10th double suicide bombing. In that case, a YouTube video was posted by Jabhat al-Nusra, the Victory Front, and it was released online. And the terrorist organization came out and said, that's not our video. They didn't say that they didn't do the terrorist attack, but they've been putting everything out on their own website. It's called the White Minaret that they created. And so they have been perpetrating the killing, but then it would seem like the Assad regime also has a interest in just making it seem like everything is happening, according to jihadists, that they're the ones responsible.
And in some cases, at least, you believe that it is the Assad regime itself that is blowing things up or otherwise creating these pretexts for its action.
A long history from 2004, 2005, 2006, also, where there were different shadowy terrorist organizations operating in Damascus where the regime would manage to foil supposed attacks. And they would always coincide with international pressure falling on the Syrian regime. And they were basically used to just divert attention.
And so, by support from the international community, so-called, for the regime. Listen, we're going to run out of time before we can get to all of the issues that this fascinating vortex represents, Matt Brodsky. But talk to me quickly, if you would, about some of the regional players and the role that they have at the moment in this drama in Syria, including Iran, including Lebanon, including Turkey and Saudi Arabia.
Well, this is where apparently American foreign policy has been outsourced to right now. It's been outsourced to Russia. There's apparently a plan that the Obama administration would like to convince Vladimir Putin to get Assad to step down. That, of course, will never happen. But so you have Russia sending all sorts of weapons. You have Iran sending weapons, and there you have people. They have soldiers there who are training. You have Hezbollah.
These weapons are all in the hands of the regime.
Of the regime.
The Russians and Iranians are supporting the regime. Okay.
Right. You have Saudi Arabia and Qatar are delivering weapons and private financiers from the Gulf to the Free Syrian Army against the regime. You have Turkey, another place that we're outsourcing our foreign policy also, because we have them essentially looking over the Syrian National Council, which is the exiled governing group that is unified on basically nothing right now. So you have Turkey, Russia, Iran, the main players, and only it would appear Saudi Arabia and Qatar who are financing or helping the Free Syrian Army.
Okay. And the Free Syrian Army is, as I understand it, a relatively secular group. Are they, in your estimation, Matt Brodsky of the Jewish Policy Center, the best hope for the United States of an outcome other than either Assad remaining in power, which is pretty unpalatable, or the Muslim Brotherhood, or perhaps worse, Al-Qaeda, maybe, coming to the fore?
It would have to be the Free Syrian Army that we would help through arming or training, but that's the only path forward for us. The Syrian National Council, again, being the exiled leadership group, which is dominated by the Muslim Brotherhood, they are in disagreement with the Free Syrian Army, who is actually on the ground, and the Free Syrian Army has been calling for outside intervention for months now. And it's only them who, with weapons, are going to be able to defeat, or it's the only chance of defeating, the Assad regime.
And Matt Brodsky, very quickly, are we clear about who is making up the Free Syrian Army? These are defectors from the Syrian Army itself. Are they authentically, well, on our side?
It's different in every case. And right now it could just be that they would like American help, I mean, which they've been calling for, so they would appear to be on our side. But I would say that they are mostly secular, but again, you know, Islam plays a large role within Syria, so there are still elements of Islamist, but it's, you know, it's far different than, say, a Jabhat al-Nusra, a terrorist organization, you know, calling for Sharia law.
Right. Well, it's the kind of thing that we turn to folks like you to help us understand. Matt Brodsky of the Jewish Policy Center, where he directs policy. Also, you are the editor of In Focus Quarterly. We look forward to the new edition of World Almanac of Islamism and your chapter on Syria there. A lot, obviously, has been happening, as we've been discussing, that you address, and we look forward to visiting with you further as this drama plays out, and we try to get some clarity as to what it would be in our interest to do, and I suspect that is not what the Obama administration is doing at the moment. Matt, thanks so much for joining us. We'll talk with you again soon. Next up, we will be talking with Gordon Chang.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I was able to lose the 80 pounds I gained due to pregnancy. It was pretty easy. Eat whatever I wanted and not think about it.
The Meta System from Judy Singer has been helping make weight loss easier for a quarter century.
My husband's grandmother used it 20 years ago to lose weight for a wedding and said it was the only way to go.
The Meta System also has an excellent support staff.
They were very supportive. The first time that I ordered the product, they called me and suggested that I order a lower dosage to begin with. They didn't want me to jump the gun right off the bat, and it was nice to know that they actually cared.
And the weight loss is so dramatic, people wonder.
With the Meta System, I've got many questions about how I managed raising a baby and working full-time and lose the weight and eat whatever I wanted.
People who use it recommend it.
I suggested the Meta System to my mother, and she has lost 30 pounds.
Learn more about weight loss with Judy Singer's The Meta System by calling 800-711-JUDY, 800-711-JUDY. The Meta System from Judy Singer, the powerful all-natural way to lose weight, 800-711-JUDY.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a non-profit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
In Washington, Hugh Hewitt has the diagnosis.
They don't understand the need for speed.
Oh, we'll get to it. Don't worry. We'll get it done. Open amendment process, blah, 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 blah.
Not in the least bit clued in to the sense of urgency, but I don't think the Beltway is.
I'm just beginning to think it is a Beltway disease.
Kind of an invisible wall separates them from what the people think.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org. Even if it's just everyday stuff, like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined, as we are each week, by Gordon Chang, our duty expert on Asia, that of Forbes.com, WorldAffairsJournal.com, and Fox News. He's a man we turn to, especially to try to penetrate some of the seemingly impenetrable aspects of what's happening in Asia. Not so impenetrable, Gordon Chang, is the tour there this week of the Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta. His message is quite unmistakable, that America is an Asian power. You guys can have confidence in us. We'll help be a counterweight to the Chinese. Maybe he'll say that more explicitly in private than in public. But it does, in fact, the audience in Asia credit what the Secretary of Defense is saying at the same time that he's obviously presiding over the hollowing out, as it's been described, of the U.S. military?
The audience in Asia really will be looking at two things as Panetta tours the region. First of all, it's going to be the cutbacks in the U.S. military and how much in the way will the U.S. allocate to the region, because that is extremely important. So the issue of defense cutbacks, you know, is a topic of conversation from the top to the bottom of the region. And the second thing that people in the region will be looking at is how we support the Philippines. Because for the last 7 weeks, the Philippines and the Chinese have been engaged in a tense standoff around Scarborough Shoal, which is very close to the Philippine shores and very far from China. But China claims it, and China is trying to overwhelm Scarborough Shoal with Chinese vessels. The United States has a mutual defense treaty with the Philippines, and people around the region are going to be looking at what we do to protect the Filipinos from this aggressive Chinese action.
And Gordon, when we last took stock with you about this, we were, well, nowhere to be seen, as I understand it. Are we demonstrating with a show of force or otherwise support for the Filipinos at this point? Or do you expect that to be something that Panetta addresses directly?
I don't know whether Panetta will actually talk about this directly. The only thing the United States has done is it's sent a nuclear submarine, which has went to a Subic naval base to port. And then basically the Pentagon said that this was not connected with the Scarborough Shoal matter, but obviously the Chinese must have taken some note of what was going on. I think that really what's happening is Panetta will be having some pretty serious conversations with the Chinese and as well with the Filipinos about all of this, because this is the one incident that could turn the region upside down overnight, especially because this is not going away. Everybody, including me, said that this was going to be solved very soon, and now we're going to go on to our eighth week.
Yeah, no resolution seemingly in sight. Gordon, I guess it is a perfect segue to a piece that you wrote recently in World Affairs Journal about China and the Law of the Sea Treaty. The fact that they are making these exaggerated claims of sovereignty over wide areas of the South China Sea clearly is totally athwart their commitments under this treaty. And you've argued, I think quite persuasively, a further reason why we should be very chary of the administration's arguments that we need to become a member ourselves by ratifying the treaty. Give us your thoughts on that.
Yeah, in Washington, you hear a lot of people say, well, we need to ratify the treaty because if we do that, we can hold the Chinese responsible to compliance with the treaty. The problem, you know, and that sounds okay on the surface, but the real problem with this argument is that you look back, first of all, China is violating this treaty left, right, and center. They're making claims that are incompatible with the strictures in the treaty. But also, more important, we need to look at China's compliance with prior treaties. We made these same arguments in connection with trade, that China joining the World Trade Organization. We made these arguments in connection with nuclear nonproliferation, with the Chinese ratifying the global treaty. And yet China is turned out to be a trade criminal on one hand, and also remains the world's arch proliferator of nuclear weapons technology, especially to dangerous regimes like Iran. So, you know, historically, these type of arguments that we have heard in Washington about trying to bind the Chinese just don't have really any basis in what we're seeing in their behavior.
Yeah, it turns out they bind us in ways that are going to be, I believe, very, very harmful in the case of the Law of the Sea Treaty, but they're selectively observed by the Chinese, sort of double whammy. Gordon Chang, one of the things that you've contributed to our thinking about probably as much as anything is the really serious economic turmoil going on in China, communist China right now. You've been speculating for some time about the coming collapse of China, the title of a book that you wrote about a decade ago now. You've written very recently in Forbes.com, in your column there, about what appears to be a quite astonishing change of course by the communist Chinese with respect to private capital in China. Is that real, and is it impelled by the kind of desperate circumstance they find themselves in, and will it work if they in fact implement this this new approach?
Well, Frank, you're right. Astonishing is the word. After more than a half decade of really anti-foreigner sentiment of trying to close up their economy, in a series of announcements in the last couple of weeks, Premier Wen Jiabao and the State Council have announced that they are going to allow private capital into many sectors of the Chinese economy. And it runs the gamut. This has really been very, very interesting. It comes all at the same time. I think it shows how desperate they are in terms of the decline in the Chinese economy, which we've seen over the last 4 or 5 months, actually over the last six, but especially pronounced in March and April. And I think that they will not have the real opportunity to implement these because Premier Wen Jiabao is about to leave office. The Chinese political system right now is in turmoil. It's going to go through a transition. And right now, I don't think leaders have the time to actually make these rules and put them into practice. And so I think that what we're seeing right now is a lot of vaporware. Chinese officials trying to convince us that they're change their policy, but they won't really will be able to do it.
Mm. Do you anticipate that it will be attractive to private investment at this point? Is the underlying problem not still a question of the rule of law or the absence thereof in China?
Well, you know, historically, investors have jumped at the opportunity to invest in the Chinese economy, but I think this time it won't be attractive, and the reason is that the Chinese economy is sliding too fast. And at this point, nobody really wants to commit money to Greece, so they're not going to commit money to China for the very same reason. There's just too much uncertainty. There's too much bad news. Basically, Beijing has to turn the economy around before people are going to really commit substantial sums to the economy.
We're talking again with Gordon Chang, our duty expert on Asia, and an author and essayist, columnist with Forbes.com, among other outlets. Gordon, just very quickly in the remaining minute and a half we have or so, we spoke last week about American Federal Reserve governors allowing China to have a presence in our market, three state-owned banks. You expressed some concern about the solvency of those banks if they were properly audited. Our friend Roger Robinson was on last week after your appearance and expressed concern about American depositors being able to now have renminbi accounts, non-convertible currency, and sort of raising the specter that maybe this is a step towards a new reserve currency in the offing to displace the dollar. Do you see that connection?
Yes, Roger's right. The Chinese definitely want the renminbi to become the world's new reserve currency, displacing the dollar. And they do a lot of these small moves to try to get their increasing acceptance for their currency. The problem is that they really will not implement the one step that is necessary for a reserve currency, and that is for it to be freely convertible. The Chinese renminbi is convertible on the current account. It is not convertible on the capital account. Chinese leaders talk about making it convertible on the capital account, but they never do it because if they did that, they would lose control of their economy, and they're certainly not going to do that while it's in this precipitous slide. So the Chinese leaders can do all these little moves all they want, but they're really not going to get where they need to be in their own minds, and that is a fully convertible currency that has the possibility of challenging the dollar.
We'll be watching it closely with you, Gordon Chang. Thank you for your expertise and insights and for sharing them with us each week. Look forward to talking with you again next week and to talking with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.